Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Gnar Trees podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book, The House of Rothschild, Volume 2, The World's Banker, 1849 to 1999 by Niall Ferguson, continues the saga of the most famous banking dynasty in modern history, shifting from the era of revolutionary wars to the long, turbulent century that followed. Covering the period from the mid-19th century to the end of the 20th, the book tracks how the Rothschild family navigated industrialization, imperial expansion, financial globalization, and two world wars while protecting the cohesion of a far-flung family firm. Ferguson, a historian known for blending political and economic narrative, uses the Rothschild story to illuminate how high finance intersects with diplomacy, infrastructure building, and rather than treating banking as an abstract system, the book presents it as a network of relationships, reputations, and hard constraints, including regulation, nationalism, and shifting public attitudes toward wealth. It also examines the family's evolution from government bond underwriting toward broader investment roles, and how the Rothschild name became both a commercial brand and a target of controversy. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, rebuilding and repositioning. After 1848, the book opens in the aftermath of the revolutions of 1848, when European politics and capital markets were both volatile and the earlier Rothschild model of financing states was under pressure. Ferguson portrays the family not as a static symbol of old-world finance, but as a set of partners adapting to new realities, expanding railways, rising corporate firms, and intensifying competition from newer banks. A key theme is strategic repositioning. The Rothschilds had to decide when to remain close to sovereign lending and when to place capital and expertise into infrastructure, mining, and other productive assets that shaped economic development. This period also highlights the importance of reputation and information. The firm's value was not only money, but also credibility, cross-border intelligence, and the ability to execute large transactions when markets were skittish. The narrative shows how family governance mattered, with coordination across London, Paris, Vienna, and other centers requiring trust, agreed standards, and a shared sense of risk. In this way, the post-1848 decades become a case study in institutional resilience, how an established financial house sustains dominance by adjusting its mix of services while keeping the core advantages of networks and discretion. Secondly, finance, diplomacy, and the management of empire, a central thread in the book, is the tight linkage between international finance and high politics during the age of empire. Ferguson uses the Rothschilds to explain how capital markets influenced diplomatic options and how political decisions altered the price and availability of capital. The family's connections to governments and central banks are presented as practical, transaction-based relationships rather than simple puppetry. States needed reliable intermediaries for loans, bond placements, and payments, while financiers needed stable regimes and enforceable contracts. The book shows how this mutual dependence played out in moments of crisis, such as wars, balance of payment strains, and debates over monetary standards. It also explores the ethical and reputational challenges of operating in imperial contexts, where investments could be framed as development, exploitation, or strategic leverage depending on the observer. By examining the mechanics of underwriting, syndication, and cross-border settlement, Ferguson illustrates how a banking house could function as an informal bridge between governments and markets. This topic helps readers understand that the Rothschilds' power lay less in secret control and more in their capacity to mobilize trust, coordinate large pools of capital, and navigate the constraints that politics imposed on finance. Thirdly, war, upheaval, and the limits of private banking. The 20th century portion of the book emphasizes how war and ideological upheaval tested the premise that private banking networks could remain above politics. Ferguson examines how the two world wars, shifting alliances, and revolutionary movements disrupted cross-border operations and forced hard choices about exposure, loyalty, and survival. The Rothschilds faced asset seizures, currency instability, capital controls, and the breakdown of old financial circuits. The book also highlights the personal dimension family members, partners, and staff had to operate under mounting public scrutiny and, at times, open hostility toward bankers, elites, and Jewish families. These pressures revealed limits to discretion and internationalism. Even the best-connected firm could not fully hedge against regimes that repudiated obligations or weaponized finance. Yet the narrative also shows persistence through adaptation, including reorganization of holdings, a shift in business lines, and the cultivation of new relationships as the center of gravity in finance moved. By focusing on institutional responses rather than only dramatic events, Ferguson provides a framework for understanding how shocks propagate through financial systems and how legacy institutions decide when to retrench, when to diversify, and when to exit entire jurisdictions. Fourthly, from family house to modern financial institution, another major topic is modernization. How the Rothschild firm evolved as banking became more regulated, more corporate, and increasingly shaped by professional management. Ferguson traces the tension between the advantages of a family partnership model and the demands of scale, transparency, and compliance that grew across the 20th century. As competitors expanded through joint stock structures, universal banking, and new capital market instruments, the Rothschilds had to refine what differentiated them. The book explores the gradual movement toward advisory roles, investment management, and specialized transactions that leveraged the brand for discretion and expertise rather than sheer balance sheet size. It also emphasizes governance problems familiar to many family enterprises: succession, coordination among branches, and aligning incentives when the business environment rewards speed and innovation. Readers see how the Rothschild name operated simultaneously as an asset and a constraint, attracting clients who valued prestige while inviting political suspicion and conspiracy thinking. In describing these shifts, Ferguson offers a broader lesson about institutional evolution and capitalism. Firms survive not by repeating past formulas, but by identifying where their capabilities remain scarce, then reorganizing structures and culture to deliver those capabilities in new markets. Lastly, myth, public perception, and the real sources of power. Ferguson devotes significant attention to the gap between the Rothschilds' real activities and the myths that surrounded them. The family has long been portrayed as omnipotent financiers, and the book situates such claims within broader patterns of populism, anti-Semitism, and suspicion of market power. Rather than amplifying conspiratorial narratives, Ferguson treats perception as a historical force in its own right. Rumors can affect political decisions, regulatory actions, and client behavior, regardless of accuracy. This topic clarifies what actually generated influence in 19th and 20th century finance. It was not absolute control, but comparative advantage in information, networks, and credibility, combined with an ability to structure deals and manage risk across borders. The book also shows how philanthropy, social integration, and cultural patronage shaped the family's standing, sometimes softening hostility and sometimes provoking backlash. By analyzing both reality and reputation, Ferguson provides readers with tools to think critically about how financial power is constructed and contested. The Rothschild case demonstrates that legitimacy is a form of capital, and that a firm's endurance depends as much on public narratives and political context as on spreadsheets, interest rates, and contracts. In conclusion, this book suits readers who want a serious, historically grounded understanding of global finance, including students of economic history, international relations, and political economy, as well as professionals curious about how reputation and networks shape markets over the long run. It will also appeal to general history readers who enjoy biographies that double as panoramic accounts of world events. The benefit is perspective. By following one dynasty through industrialization, imperial rivalry, wars, and late 20th century globalization, the reader learns how finance actually works in practice, how capital flows respond to shocks, and why institutions that appear unassailable can be constrained by politics, regulation, and public sentiment. Compared with many books on banking that focus narrowly on crises or on modern investment products, Ferguson offers a long-horizon narrative that links boardroom choices to diplomatic realities and social change. The result is a richer explanation of why certain financial intermediaries mattered, what they could and could not do, and how they adapted when the center of financial gravity shifted. It is worth buying because it combines the drama of world history with an analytical account of institutions, making complex financial history readable without reducing it to slogans. If you would like to support Niall Ferguson, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.